Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
It is the final episode of September here on Legal Face Off, WGN Radio, WGNRadio.com. The Legal Eagles are here. Rich Linkoff and Tina Martini. My name is Sam Panionovich, and Ben Anderson is behind the glass. We'll talk about the Me Too movement, the Me Too men, though. We'll also discuss Inside Out, the legal grab bag at the end of the show. But Rich, as you know, one of the first things we covered here on Legal Face Off, one of the first stories we ever talked about, back to October 2014, the shooting of Laquan McDonald. And now Jason Van Dyke is at trial and joining us to talk about the case, Eric Rung from WGN News. Eric, welcome to LFO.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Eric, you literally stepped out of court to call in, so we really appreciate the update. The defense began their case yesterday after prosecutors rested on Friday, or on Thursday, actually, after 4 days of testimony. We heard from the pathologist yesterday, which we'll get to in a moment. But tell us what's going on in court today.
Well, we've had a lot of breaks today, to be quite honest with you. There's been a lot of action with the attorneys and the judge inside chambers. So far, there's only been one witness that was been called today. That was another juvenile probation officer who was the probation officer for Laquan McDonald up until he was killed on October 20th, 2014. She testified that in court, when he was taken into custody, that he had become physically combative with some of the sheriff's deputies that were taking him into custody. This is something we've seen from the defense from since they opened the cases, that they're trying to paint Laquan McDonald as a very violent teen that had a lot of issues, was prone to violence, did not like authority telling him what to do. The prosecution basically has countered that by saying, did you tell Jason Van Dyke any of this information prior to October 20th, 2014? And, of course, the answer is no. So basically what they're saying is that Jason Van Dyke would have had no prior knowledge of any of this behavior prior to that night when they encountered each other on Pulaski.
So, Eric, yesterday there was a lot of testimony from the pathologist about how Laquan McDonald died, which shot killed him. Do you care to, just tell our listeners a little bit more about that testimony from yesterday?
It was very interesting, mostly due to the fact that Chakoutis, that's who the witness was. She's a forensic pathologist. She had worked at the Cook County Medical Examiner's Office. Now she is a paid witness. She said she's been testifying for the prosecution in some cases, for the defense and others. But her testimony seemed to contradict the video that we have all seen so many times. She was saying that Laquan McDonald was likely standing for 14 of the shots out of the 16 that hit him, and she said only one conclusively hit him on the ground. She said the other one may have happened while he was on his way to the ground. You can see him spin and then come down. But the video and the prosecution has shown that after Jason Van Dyke opened fire within 6 seconds of getting out of his squad car, Laquan McDonald hit the ground in 1.6 seconds. So that means, just doing some math, I mean, he would have had to get all 16 shots or 14 shots off in about a second and a half, which would obviously be very, very difficult to do. She also was talking a lot about the shots that killed Laquan McDonald. She thought it was either the first or the second shot that killed him. The one, you'll remember that he was shot once in the chest. She said that hit his pulmonary artery, and that would have caused him to die within 1 to 5 minutes, and the chance of survival were almost zero unless there was a surgical team waiting and knew exactly what had happened, which, of course, is not that didn't happen. But she was really testifying that with one of those two shots, the rest of the shots, and she said this in court, didn't matter. The prosecution said, well, it mattered to Laquan McDonald, and she said that some of the gunshot wounds that Laquan McDonald received likely could have been post-mortem, so after he had died. The defense throughout this case has tried to make a very large point of it's important when Laquan McDonald died. Did he die at the scene or did he die at the hospital? and I'm a little confused, I guess, on why where he died mattered, because it's whether or not Jason Van Dyke had the intent to kill him that night. That's the first degree murder charge.
Well, one of the things
goes to the aggravated battery.
Yeah, one of the things you look for, I mean, certainly in civil cases, which I handle, you know, I defend those cases. The plaintiff is always trying to show as much time that the plaintiff had to suffer. So in a civil case, and it's similar in a criminal case, the longer you can show that someone had to suffer from a gunshot wound, you know, I don't want to use the term better, but the stronger your case is. So I think what they're trying to do is gain some sympathy from the jury, showing that, you know, the longer he had to wait before he died, the worse it is. But I want to ask you about the jury, because you've been in court now for a while. I think every day, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've been watching this jury. You've been watching the jury the entire 6 or 7 days now. You know, I pick juries frequently in my career. I'm always fascinated with what you can tell from the jury's demeanor, body language, etc. I know you and I talked recently about the fact that Van Dyke has not really shown much emotion. He hasn't made a lot of eye contact. What, if anything, can you tell from the body language of both the defendant, Van Dyke, and any of the jury members?
Well, for the jury, it's been really interesting because there are some jurors that are taking copious notes. I mean, page after page after page of notes. And then there's some that jot down things here or there. They all appear to be very attentive, with the exception of yesterday when the forensic pathologist for the defense was talking, and she was on the stand for 3 hours. Toward the end of that testimony, it seemed as if the jury had kind of checked out, kind of swiveling in their chair. And I don't want to say checked out, but they weren't paying as close attention as they were at the beginning.
Did you think they were just bored, or do you think they were just bored, or did you take that as not buying what she was saying?
I took it as more of, we've already gone over this over and over and over again, and you guys are arguing about, you know, the process of death versus somebody being alive, and it almost became more between the special prosecutor and the forensic pathologist than it did about the case at that point. I mean, it was almost them doing battle against each other. So I think that's what probably, again, just my perception of what I saw was that the jury didn't appear that they were all that interested in that. They were more interested and have been interested in the videos that have been shown by the prosecution. Of course, the defense is going to put on their own animated version of events that night from Jason Van Dyke's perspective. We could see that today with a video expert that's coming. So that was the only point I would say, since this trial has begun, that I kind of saw the jury kind of, all right, we're over this, let's move on. That's the only time, though.
Eric, what
but
is
Jason
the...
Van Dyke, for he has remained pretty stoic throughout. I mean, rarely, every once in a while, somebody will have like a wisecrack at the judge or you know, something like that, and he'll kind of, you know, have a half smile on his face, but other than that, he pretty much stares down at his notes, talks to his attorneys. I mean, he's involved in the case and he's definitely paying attention, but he doesn't really look at the jury. He doesn't really look at the special prosecutors. He's pretty focused on the notebook in front of him and talking with his attorneys as this trial proceeds.
So, Eric, what is the general mood in the courtroom? I mean, it sounds like people are pretty focused on what's going on. Van Dyke's wife is there, or at least was there yesterday. Apparently, she was there with a priest and a nun from their parish. What is the general mood in the courtroom?
Well, and she's here again today with the priest and nun as well, sitting right next to him in the courtroom. You know, Judge Gunn has kept a very, very strict decorum in that courtroom as far as what you can and cannot do. And people they're following it because they don't want to get kicked out, and they definitely don't want to be found in contempt. And he has threatened that over and over again. There's been no outburst. There was somebody made a loud noise, and he even kind of admonished whoever did it from the bench to not do it again. So it's very quiet. You can feel the tension in the room, especially when The attorneys are questioning and pressing a witness hard. I mean, you can feel it. You can see people's eyes kind of perk up and really start paying attention. Of course, Laquan McDonald's mother has been in the courtroom as well several times when the autopsy photos have been shown, because they've been shown now to the jury, I think, three times, each and every one of the gunshot wounds that Laquan McDonald suffered that night. She's put her head down. She hasn't really looked at those autopsy photos. A few times she had tears in her eyes. Van Dyke's wife also had tears in her eyes on a few occasions during this trial as well. As far as the public goes, I mean, it just seems, you know, they're really paying attention to what's going on, and there's no talking, really. I mean, occasionally you'll hear some of the reporters kind of ask each other, you know, did you get that spelling right, or you know, that kind of thing. But other than that, it's very quiet, and you can feel the tension in the air in there. That's for sure.
Eric, one of the big questions that's unknown right now is whether Van Dyke will testify. There are two schools of thought on these issues. On the one hand, it's the prosecution's burden of proof, and frequently criminal defense lawyers won't put their defendant on the stand for fear of making the case for the state when it otherwise has not been made. On the other hand, and in this case in particular, you know, it would be almost malpractice, I think, not to put Van Dyke on there, because your entire case rests on the jury putting themselves in the shoes of Van Dyke that night, and whether his perception that Laquan McDonald was a risk was reasonable. What is the thought among reporters covering the trial as to whether he'll testify, and what do you think?
You know, that is the million-dollar question. I just don't know. Part of me is saying, how do you put up this defense of everything relies on his point of view, and then not put him on the stand to say this was his point of view? I mean, in my experience, I would say 9 times out of 10, they would not put him on. But this is a very different case, because it all rests on what he saw that night, what he perceived as a threat. Maybe they're hoping that this video will, you know, put the doubt in the juror's mind, and so that they don't have to put him on the stand. My guess is, if they do put him on the stand, it's not going to be in the first few days of their presentation here to the jury. And my guess, it'll probably be one of the last ones, and it'll be, okay, we need to do this kind of thing. That's my guess. And just from covering court cases and my experience as a reporter for, you know, almost 20 years now, but it's a huge question, especially when that's your entire case. Is this is what he perceived that night? I don't know how. I mean, if I was a juror, I'd want to hear it. That's for sure.
Right, Eric. You mentioned, you know, your career covering criminal cases. Have you ever seen one quite like this? I mean, many are calling it the biggest, you know, criminal trial in Chicago history. I mean, it certainly ranks up there with Blagojevich and some of the, you know, Graylord cases. What's the vibe as you come into court? We've seen, you know, lots of protests. We saw in particular yesterday, you know, across. Does this one feel any different than the ones you've covered in the past?
It does, only because I think it's a police officer. And that is why it does feel different. I mean, they are allowed by law to use lethal force and are trained to do so. And I think that is why this one is so different. One thing I am surprised at is that even on opening statements, the courtroom was not packed. And again, today it's not packed. That's one big difference, I would say, from other high-profile cases that I've covered. And the protests have been kind of hit or miss. I was expecting protests out here every single day. That's what we were told. That's what the court had prepared for. That's what the Chicago Police Department had prepared for. But it hasn't really materialized. I mean, I think there was maybe 100 and so protesters out, or demonstrators out here yesterday. But other than that, you're talking about maybe a half dozen on most days. Now, that could change once this case goes to the jury. And I know, I would bet everything I own that it's going to change when a verdict comes down, especially if it's not what the demonstrators believe it should be for justice in this case. But yeah, there's a different feel to it. And I think it's mostly just because he is a law enforcement officer. And there's a lot of these cases that have gone around all over the country. And for
For the most part, in my just this last couple of years, I can't think of any case where they were actually found guilty.
That's Eric Rung on the case for WGN News, the Jason Van Dyke trial here in Chicago. Eric, I know you're busy. Thank you so much for taking time.
You got it. Happy to be on the show.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He's been selected to the 2017 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2017. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEEK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Rich also is the legal analyst for The Bill and Wendy Show and Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez on WGN. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
We roll on Legal Face-Off here on WGN Radio, WGNRadio.com. Rich, Tina, and Sam, and joining us now on the phones, John Singer, who's a partner and co-founder of Singer Deutsch LLP. We've talked so much about the Me Too movement and the accusers, but this is a gentleman and an attorney who represents the accused. Mr. Singer, welcome to WGN.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, John, we are in the era of Me Too, where there has been significant awareness and attention paid to allegations of sexual misconduct. Recently in the Wall Street Journal, you said that it has been a wonderful movement, but at the same time, there is an underbelly to it. From your perspective, what is that underbelly?
So, I think that the movement in general has been a great thing. It's been wonderful for people who have been, you know, victimized by sexual harassment or sexual misconduct. But we've been seeing a lot of in our practice and pretty much right out of the chute when the movement began is that firms are cognizant of the movement and cognizant of the need to garner positive PR are oftentimes letting people go without doing a fulsome investigation and then also concurrently communicating folks' departures to the press, which is something they never did before. So for the last, you know, 50 years or so of our jurisprudence, when an employee was let go, the firms would never utter that person's name in the media. Now they're going out of their way to do so even before engaging in what we consider comprehensive or even fair investigations.
John, you've represented many prominent men accused of sexual misconduct, including Harold Ford Jr., who was removed from Morgan Stanley last year. After the bank learned of a claim of unwanted advances, Harold Ford, of course, is a former congressman. Obviously, this week we're dealing with the upcoming hearings on Thursday with Judge Kavanaugh. And, you know, this is quite a polarizing issue, of course, one that you've been dealing with for years. Folks who are supporting Kavanaugh say that you can't just jump to the conclusion that he is guilty because of one accusation, or in this case, two accusations, maybe a third if Michael Avenatti does produce a witness. On the other side are folks who are saying that, you know, this is so traumatic that you have to give the presumption of truthfulness to the accusers. Again, these are issues that you deal with all the time. Where do you stand on those dichotomies?
Well, obviously, I can't comment on Harold's situation or on any of our other present or former clients, but just in general terms, what we've been seeing in our practice is a trend whereby, you know, the firms, again, as I alluded to earlier, are quite anxious to garner whatever positive PR they can and also to placate whatever segment of their workforce that may be disgruntled as a result of a sexual harassment allegation, and they're not doing what we consider to be comprehensive or fulsome investigations. And what happens is that they're very quick, the firms are, and we see it in all industries, whether it's in on Wall Street or whether it's in entertainment or whether it's in broadcast television. We've got clients who run the gamut, and what they're doing is that they're acting impulsively and they're not getting to the facts. These cases, and we represent as well women who are who are making accusations and have made accusations of sexual harassment against the firm. So we've got both male and female clients. What we're seeing, though, what should be happening is the firms need to do comprehensive investigations before they act, because what they're doing is that they're acting rashly. They're infusing matters into the public domain, and people are then unable going forward to either attain new employment, or it even has widespread ramifications for people's personal lives too. So that's simply what we're seeking is due process, whereby the firms take a breath, they take in an accusation, and they do a proper investigation before they do something to somebody.
So how do you strike that balance? Because obviously, as you said, there's a need to do a thorough investigation, but at the same time, there are concerns from a liability perspective of that type of investigation going on too long. So how do you thread that needle, and how do you know when you've done enough diligence for purposes of figuring out what the path forward should be?
So just as a hypothetical, let's assume that a male superior is at an event, let's say it's a Christmas party, or perhaps it's a golf outing or something of the like with a female subordinate, and there's an allegation thereafter that the male acted inappropriately. What the firm needs to do is they need to take that allegation seriously, and as someone who represents sexual harassment victims, we want the firms to take it seriously. We don't want it to be marginalized. But what the firms need to do is they need to then bring in the various individuals who may have been present at that outing, various individuals who may have been on text message communications with the accuser after the event. There's all kinds of ways to do a proper comprehensive investigation to get to the bottom of it. So they can thread the needle by taking in the facts, acting quickly to do an investigation, and then at the end thereafter to make their findings and act appropriately. But what we have not been seeing that. We've been seeing that what the firms are doing is they're receiving allegations and immediately presuming that the accused has engaged in wrongdoing, and that then is accompanied by either an immediate suspension or firing, and the concurrent infusion of that matter into the public domain, which again has incredibly detrimental ramifications for the accused, for the person who's been accused.
John, we know you don't represent Brett Kavanaugh, but he is huddling with his lawyers now for a couple of weeks in preparation for what promises to be an explosive day on Thursday. If you were counseling him, what would you be telling him this week? We saw him on Fox News last night with his wife, unequivocally denying the allegations that are made against him. But it's going to come down, as many have now said, to his testimony against what seems to be only one person testifying on Thursday. You've talked about how this is as much a public relations issue as much as a legal issue. What advice would you give Brett Kavanaugh in preparation for Thursday?
So I hate to play the stereotypical lawyer who wants to shirk questions, but that's a tough one for me to answer. As an employment lawyer who focuses, all of his time on employment issues and dealing with employers and employees, I think this is such a different issue. I mean, the underlying allegations are sexual misconduct, but they don't involve employers. They don't involve issues in the workplace. These are issues, esoteric issues that are very specific to the court and to politics. And I can't tell you what I would advise him, because it's so far out of our realm of practice.
We know, John, you also used to run a Patriots newsletter, and you got a little bit busy, but maybe we'll see you, because the Pats come to Chicago October 21st. Maybe we'll get you in studio.
Well, I'm very fearful of what Khalil Mack and Roquan Smith are going to do to Tom Brady, given our lack of given our protection and the frontline issues. So I don't think I'm going to come to that game. I think the Patriots are going to lose, but the Bears seem to have something special going, so that's good for them.
What happened to the newsletter, by the way? What's
that?
What happened to the newsletter?
So the newsletter, what happened was I educated everybody with such great detail that I was no longer needed. I mean, I think people finally understood that they've been a poor drafting team, that Tom Brady has made Bill Belichick who Bill Belichick is, not the other way around. I think I educated everybody, and now I'm no longer necessary. Plus, I got really busy at work, too. So,
that's John Singer, partner, co-founder of Singer Deutsch LLP. To learn more, singerdeutsch.com. John, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
We all know the legal world is complex and high-pressured. There's no room for error. That's why judges and attorneys across Chicagoland have trusted the expert court reporters at McCorkle Litigation Services since 1948. McCorkle Litigation Services has accurately recorded every word from thousands of legal proceedings. McCorkle Litigation Services provides the legal community with peace of mind, transcribing testimony and depositions that can be used reliably by jurors, judges, and attorneys. For all of your legal support needs, contact McCorkle Litigation Services online at McCorkleLitigation.com.
Our last guest here on Legal Faceoff is somebody you know pretty well, David Susler, joining us for Inside Out with Tina Martini, Rich Lenkov, Sam Panionovich. Today, we're talking about the importance of teamwork.
We have a team here of Inside Out columnists. I'm trying to figure out who we should start with. Tina Martini, the column, as Sam mentioned, discusses teamwork. Why, from an outside counsel perspective, is teamwork so important when dealing with your clients?
It's really important because there's a lot of stuff that I can't do on my own. And depending on the complexity of a project for a client, I usually have to work with others in some shape or form, whether they are other partners or associates or staff attorneys or paralegals. I usually am teaming up on any given client with at least two other people the way that we staff things. So it's really important to make sure you have the right people working with the client.
David, when I work with my clients, what I like to see as my role is not an attorney, not a vendor, but as a partner. What I try to do is learn as much as possible about my client's business so I could truly be part of the team and not just viewed as, you know, someone they hire. You're inside counsel. You hire outside counsel all the time. You just won a trial where you teamed with outside counsel. What qualities do you look for when you're hiring outside counsel to ensure that they are truly a member of your team and not just someone who is billing you to, you know, provide some outside legal services?
Well, that's a good question.
It's a long question, by the way. It's one of the longest questions ever on Inside Out.
I find that hard to believe, Rich.
Par for the course.
Yes.
And your question kind of contains the answer. And one of the critical components is an outside attorney who will take the time to get to know my business and get to know me, and when necessary, get to know my business colleagues. Because it's sort of like one of my favorite adages, which is businesses don't have legal problems; they have business problems with legal aspects. So I need outside counsel who are going to understand my business, which will help inform the legal answers we need.
Tina, you've been in charge of hiring for many years over the course of your career. It's important to bring new attorneys, younger attorneys, into this teamwork approach. How do you spot individuals who will fit into the team and not just, you know, be individuals who are worried about their own career and billing and developing their own business?
Great question. I have used for many years the type of interviewing called behavioral interviewing. I think that it's really hard to figure out how collaborative somebody is going to be unless you ask pointed questions to elicit answers to get a sense as to how people work in teams and how they value collaboration and developing camaraderie among their coworkers. And so what I like to do is ask them questions about their prior work experience. Hopefully they've had some type of substantive work experience before going to law school or even during law school that they can share with me when I interview them, and that they can share with the team of interviewers as we're trying to vet candidates to get a sense as to how they get things done and how well they work with others.
David, your feelings on that. You obviously interact with lots of younger attorneys as well. You've done mentoring for years. How do you work with newer attorneys to make sure that they understand the teamwork concept?
Well, I enjoy working with younger attorneys, and sort of the first and most important piece of advice that I give them when working with me is don't pretend you know more than you know. I know, as a young attorney, you don't really know anything, but you can learn, and that's what I'm going to rely on you. So ask me questions and be honest with me about what you know and don't know, and then we're going to get along fine.
David, you're a generalist. It's your job to know a lot of different subject areas. Tina, it's easy for attorneys to sometimes want to cover a lot of different bases. In your column, you talk about knowing each individual's strengths and weaknesses. How do you balance your desire as an attorney to be a problem solver and be all things to all people while also understanding your limitations within the framework of teamwork?
Great question. What I try to do, particularly, for example, as I'm wearing the hat of a relationship partner for a particular client, is to educate myself enough, not just about my own area of law, but about other areas of law, particularly those in which my clients tend to play in, so that I can issue spot. I would say knowing enough to be dangerous, but not really being dangerous, because at the point where I know I'm stepping outside of my comfort zone, meaning that, like, I'm an IP lawyer, but we start getting into a securities question, knowing enough to be able to issue spot, but then turning it over to one of my trusted colleagues who I know is going to gel well with the client to be able to work through the details with them so that they can get the answers that they need.
David, last question here on Legal Face-Off. We always like to probe your vast musical knowledge, not only as in-house counsel, but as one of the foremost experts in rock music in this country. You love Bruce Springsteen, as do I. Bruce Springsteen has teamed up with many artists over the years for amazing collaborations. If you had to pick one example of Bruce Springsteen teamwork that really resonated with you, what would that be, David Sussler?
Well, I was actually just listening to it this morning, and I would say the song Sea of Heartbreak that he did with Roseanne Cash on her album The List. And I think they won a Grammy for it, but
that is why you have David Sussler. Because, you know, you could have picked some cliched answer, but that really digs back in the treasure troves of Springsteen collaborations.
Love that song. Awesome collaboration.
Tina Martini, either Bruce Springsteen, who I know you're a fan of, or any other musicians that have really blended well together, have approached that teamwork that you so speak of?
You know, there are a number of them, but I would say the ones that immediately come to mind are Robert Plant and Alison Krauss.
Mm.
Have you heard that album?
I have. Very good.
And they were awesome
in concert.
I almost
put that album on this morning.
Ooh! Mental telepathy, Sussler.
You've joined us on WGN
awesome,
today.
Awesome
musical teamworks on WGN. Well, those are some great examples, but no team, I would venture to say, exhibits the collaborative approach to teamwork as well as the Inside Out columnist, Sestini. Sam, take it away.
I just want to know what's on column 100. You guys are on 80. Do we have everything planned out till 100?
I'm just trying to get through the next 5 minutes, Sam. I'm not so sure about column 100, but I'm sure that we'll keep going
and
strong
that,
as long as Chicago Lawyer wants us.
Tina Martini, David Sussler, the September 2018 column is Inside Out, and the topic, the importance of teamwork. Thank you both. And we'll wrap it up the way we always do on Legal Face-Off. It's legal grab bag time. Rich, Tina, and Sam, and joining us in the studio, Kathy Curran-Quilty, who's an HR specialist for Smith Senior Living, and Paul Farvar, attorney at Farvar Law Group and the owner of Shoeshine Boy Productions. He's also a comedian. That's quite the list there. Rich, six topics. Take it away.
Most of us as lawyers want to be comedians, but Farvar is the only one who's actually successfully doing it.
I mean, successful is subjective, but yes, I am doing it.
Yes. All right. So let's jump into our first topic here. Bill Cosby, breaking news. He is undergoing a sentencing hearing. Tina, bring us up to speed as of right now, right?
Yeah, I was just going to say, the last 15 minutes, the judge in the sentencing hearing ruled that Bill Cosby is a sexually violent predator. We've been all watching this hearing over the past couple of days, and that was one of the key things that emerged from yesterday, is whether or not Bill Cosby would receive this classification. This means that Cosby must now undergo lifetime counseling and report quarterly to the authorities, and his name will also appear on a sex offender registry sent to neighbors, schools, and to victims. So we're still waiting to hear what his sentence will be, but that is a pretty key finding there.
So, Kathy, this will be the first celebrity actually found guilty in the Me Too movement. Lots of, you know, his attorneys are asking for leniency from the judge due to his age, due to the fact that he's blind, due to his years of charity. Do you think any of those factors should weigh into the decision-making process?
I believe maybe a few of them, but if you look at the number of victims that he's had, then not too much.
Paul, what are your thoughts? You've covered this over the years with Patty on her show.
Yeah.
What do you think obviously things are different today than they were even when this trial began. What are your thoughts on how this will play out?
I think he's going to get prison time. I mean, it doesn't, I think his attorneys are trying to get house arrest. That's what I understood from listening today. I think he's going to get prison time and he should. I mean, there's no doubt about it. He was still, there's stories now that are coming out where he was still attempting to do this modus operandi of bringing girls to his hotel room.
Yeah, and that's key. I mean, the modus operandi was really the key to this trial. As we all remember, there was a mistrial in the first case, and in this second trial, the prosecution was successful in bringing in, I think it was five accusers in addition to Andrea Constant. And the key to bringing in those other accusers was the evidence that this wasn't just a chance happening, that this is actually his MO. This is a criminal procedure that he underwent with multiple women. That's how these others came in to testify. Tina, what are your thoughts on that?
Well,
should more have testified? I mean, there was, what, 60 or so accusers? And there's some talk about whether they'll actually testify during the sentencing process. I don't think the judge is allowing them to testify here. Frequently,
yeah,
you'll see them making, you know, statements during sentencing.
Yeah, I think we know enough to move forward with the sentencing. I don't think we need to hear from more because we've established with the testimony that's already happened that there is an MO, and I don't know if we need to continue hearing more of what I believe would be very much the same.
All right, so speaking of the Me Too movement, obviously the other big story that's breaking this week, in addition to Jason Van Dyke that we just covered, is the Brett Kavanaugh hearings that will take place on Thursday. Just a couple of weeks ago, Kavanaugh seemed like a lock. The hearings seemed like they were over. Now we've got two accusers who are alleging that in high school and then again in college, Brett Kavanaugh, who is Trump's second nominee to the Supreme Court, sexually attacked one of them, and in the second case, assaulted this other alleged victim. Michael Avenatti, who is Stormy Daniels' attorney, has now alleged very publicly that he has a third victim that he's representing that will come forth with what he calls very credible evidence. He said yesterday he would release that evidence in the next 48 hours, so that puts him in about 24 hours. Tina, bring us up to speed on that story.
Sure. So as Rich mentioned, Christine Blasey Ford is going to be testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Thursday. She went to high school with Brett Kavanaugh and is alleging sexual misconduct on his part. And then over this past weekend, we heard from the second accuser, Deborah Ramirez, who claims that he sexually assaulted her when they were both at Yale. This third accuser apparently is going to be going public in the next day or so, claimed by Michael Avenatti, who yesterday, after he attended to, I believe was a hearing for Stormy Daniels in her case against Trump, told the press that he's representing her, that she has multiple security clearances, and that she is going to literally risk her life by coming forward. He also claims that she is 100% credible and that she has multiple witnesses to corroborate her story. And she also claimed that she has said that she's willing to take a polygraph test if Kavanaugh is willing to do so as well. But he didn't say anything about the specifics of the alleged sexual misconduct.
Kathy, do you think that the more victims, alleged victims that come forward, the more difficult it's going to be for senators to vote in favor of Kavanaugh? Or do you think ultimately it's his word against theirs? We've seen Kavanaugh come out very forcibly including as recently as yesterday on Fox News, and unequivocally deny these charges. How do you think this plays out, both in the Senate and then in the court of public opinion?
Well, right now, I think it's more of a he say, she say. Neither one of them has testified. And what I set more of my feelings on is the third party that hasn't come out yet. She's got a security clearance. I do believe that that's very important. And I think she might be the most credible witness.
Yeah, I think he said she was a government employee. I forget which.
I think she was with the DOJ, right?
DOJ,
wasn't
maybe,
she?
Yeah. Paul, again, you've covered these stories frequently on WGN. What are your thoughts on ultimately how this plays out on Thursday, which is going to be, you know, a big day, because that's also the day that Rod Rosenstein has his meeting with Trump to see whether he's going to continue not just overseeing the Mueller probe, but as the assistant attorney general.
Well, first off, I'd been saying it's Rod Rosenstein this whole time.
And
last night I lost this bet on WGN. It's Rod Rosenstein. But that being said, yeah, I think it's a little distraction. I don't think time is on Kavanaugh's side. I think there's more and more coming out every week, and it's only Tuesday right now. I think something else is going to happen. Already when I was on my way here, CNN was trying to break something as well. As far as this third person that Avenatti has, I mean, if it's as credible as he says, I think that's going to be damning enough where the senators who are, you know, on the cusp of changing their minds, it's enough that he's not going to get the votes. And I think his Ivanka Trump has already told Donald Trump to break ties with him. So who knows?
Yeah, maybe it's interesting. I actually thought over the weekend that Trump would pull Kavanaugh and put in Amy Barrett-Coney, who is on the short list, who's a female, younger than Kavanaugh, from Chicago, taught at Notre Dame Law School, is now on the bench for a year, actually more conservative than Kavanaugh. So in many ways would actually be a better pick. I would be smart for Trump to do that, I think, because he gets to, you know, play the martyr card with Kavanaugh and then also slide in someone who is going to be confirmed very quickly and who will be on the court longer than Kavanaugh and who is more conservative. Tina, what do you think the look is like for a bunch of white guys, white senators, to be questioning this woman on Thursday? Not a great look in the court of public opinion to be denying her allegations. We already saw Orrin Hatch say that she was mixed up. Not a great choice of words. As a female member of our show, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that, you know, whether it be this situation or any other situation, I think these guys need to proceed with caution. I think that they need to be very careful how they question her. I know that a number of folks have commented on what it will take for these hearings to be considered fair. She is going to have to lead with her story as the accuser, as Dershowitz and others have written about in the press over the past few days. But I think these guys need to be really careful how they proceed with their interrogation.
Turning to the Chicago mayoral election, which seems to be changing every day, which we've covered extensively on the show, Tina, it seems like every day we've got someone new in. I think Sam Panianiewicz is now the 45th contestant. Sam, how's your campaign going for mayor of Chicago?
How's your fundraising going?
Not great. Not great, everybody. Haven't raised any money yet.
Throw your support to someone else. But just in the last week, we've seen Preckwinkle, who's the Cook County chairperson, jump in. We saw Gary Chico, who formerly ran for mayor back in 2011. There seems to be an endless supply of people who want to take Rahm Emanuel's job. Tina, do you think some will drop out? Many are saying that Lori Lightfoot will now throw her support to Tony Preckwinkle. What are your thoughts on the myriad of people who want to be the leader of our city?
My guess is that at least a couple of people are going to drop out. I would just caution folks who are thinking of throwing their hat into the ring that splitting the vote at this point is inevitable. And so, you know, people need to be really strategic about how many people we have in this race, because you start getting some surprise results when you start splitting the vote like this.
Speaking of Van Dyke, Paul, we're going to get a jury verdict on the Van Dyke trial, certainly before the new mayor is elected. How do you think that will influence who the city picks as their next leader?
Well, first, out of full disclosure, I do want to say that I did start an exploratory committee.
and a PAC?
That is why I came on the show.
Yes.
I think that the
segment brought to you by Farvar for Mayor.
Yeah. Well, right now we're just exploring, but
Gary Chico doesn't believe in.
Yeah. Well, we're going to try not to be negative. That's what I told my staff, and by staff, it's just my nephew who's 12. But I would say that that's going to affect it to some extent. Everyone's going to try to politicize it, right? And so that's probably going to play out, how, especially with Gary McCarthy being in the race. I think he's going to have to take a stand on that as well. And I think he has strong opinions about that as well.
Moving on to the 3D gun manufacturer. We covered the story a couple of weeks ago. Got a lot of attention for the lawsuit involving whether that intellectual property should be released to the public, that being how to make a gun with a 3D printer. We've learned something new about the leader of this movement. Yes, Tina?
Yeah. So Cody Wilson, back in August when we reported this story, we learned that he was not allowed to publish these blueprints. He had been arguing that it was under his First Amendment right to, it was his right to publish them. Even though the court was pretty clear about what he couldn't do, he apparently was still selling the blueprints on flash drives to various customers in the U.S. So now he's back in the news, this time, unfortunately, with regard to sexual allegations that have been made against him by a minor in Texas. The 16-year-old girl who's involved apparently met Wilson on a dating website, and there is apparently video footage as well as numerous messages and links from the dating website on her cell phone, all of which appear to corroborate that the two had been involved. Authorities have said that there's simply no way that Wilson could have possibly believed that this girl was of age. And apparently under the Texas laws, sexual assault occurs with a victim that is under the age of 17, and they're considered to be children. So the update on this is that when he found out that she had talked to the police, he went to Taiwan. And he apparently was arrested at a hotel in Taipei on Friday, was flown back to Texas overnight, and on Sunday evening, he posted a $150,000 bond. So he is now out.
It reminds me of our buddy Shkreli.
Yes. The way he looks, and
just because these guys who are like very controversial somehow manage to end up in these other circumstances that, you know, don't end up too well for them. Guys, any thoughts on the 3D blueprint manufacturer? Good thing, bad
couldn't
thing?
Have happened to a nicer guy, right? Go. I think the system plays out itself. I think it's good that things like this happen to bad people.
A little karma there.
I wish we still had Catch a Predator out, huh? That would have prevented all this.
Yeah. What happened to Catch a Predator?
I don't know. I wish he was on the show still.
No coincidence that our former co-host Jason Whiteside is left the show around the same time as To Catch a Predator, Tina Martini? No?
Oh, yeah, and he bears a striking resemblance to him also.
Moving on to it's our typical legal comedian soccer story that we almost cover every
all right.
Every time. Jim Gaffigan, Paul, have you performed with Gaffigan?
I have not performed with Gaffigan, but he's great to work with, I've heard.
So Gaffigan, Kathy, do you know Jim Gaffigan? Very popular comedian.
Yes, I do.
He was working on, so James Kent was working on a TV commercial involving Gaffigan in 2016 when he says he was severely hurt by Gaffigan's 11-year-old daughter. He said that his daughter hit a ball, a soccer ball, that hit him in the head during the filming of this ad for a Chrysler Pacifica. Kick left him injured and unable to work, so he says in this lawsuit filed in Queens last week. Paul, have you ever been sued for kicking a soccer ball or a member of your family kicking a soccer ball too hard?
I don't have kids, so I don't have to worry about these sort. These are like the pros of being single and not having kids, I guess. But I haven't had anything like that happen. But it did say in that article that a neighbor had seen that he already had some pain, and this may just be an aggravation.
No, I find that hard to believe that someone who's filing a lawsuit for personal injuries would be exaggerating their symptoms.
Sounds like an insurance defense lawyer.
Hard to believe. Kathy, you deal with lots of people who are alleging injuries. What are your thoughts on this one? I mean, it seems a little bit
When I first read this, I laughed very hard because my son played competitive soccer all through grade school, high school, and he was like in seventh or eighth grade, and I was sitting in the sideline, and I got hit in the head with his soccer ball. He's the one that wound up kicking it. And
Did you sue a comedian for that?
No, but I wonder if I could sue my son.
You know? Sue everybody.
But, you know, that made me laugh. My one question also, I did read this, is he must be self-employed, and why didn't he go after his employer for workers' comp?
Right, right. Tina, you know, as you have heard me rail over the years about personal responsibility, isn't this a case of someone just abusing the, you know, litigation process? I mean, when you go to a game, soccer, you assume that there's some risk, right? You assume the risk that you might get hit. Why is Jim Gaffigan's daughter responsible? Even though she kicked
it. Well, because she's Jim Gaffigan's daughter,
right? Ah, there you go.
So, yeah.
Deep pockets.
Well, yeah, exactly. Deep pockets. But I also think as long as, you know, there's some reasonable measures taken to try to thwart the hazard. But, I mean, when you're at a soccer game, yes, you got to keep your eye on the ball, right?
What if you sued? Paul, have you ever been sued for not being as funny as people want when they buy their tickets? Impossible for you, of course, but
not yet.
I wonder if Gaffigan's been accused of monetary damages for that.
There have been comedy clubs that I worked at that they have been sued for people being offended. I mean, that's something that's been a lawsuit. And I think there's been others that have happened in Los Angeles at the Laugh Factory there or Comedy Store where people either offended or didn't laugh and they felt like it wasn't funny enough. But it's part of the process.
How do you deal? I mean, listen, comedy is not supposed to be, it's supposed to be offensive, right? I mean, the more offensive, the funnier. How do you balance the need to not offend people with, you got to be funny?
Well, I always tell people to know their audience. I mean, there's certain things that I know are not going to work, but I'm aware for, like, you know, I have certain I try to stay away from political stuff, but there's certain things that I say when I'm in Appleton, Wisconsin, like I was a couple weeks ago. I know it's going to offend a lot of people. And I happen to be there when the Bears and Packers were playing. So obviously mentioning the Bears is going to offend 90% of the audience in Appleton, Wisconsin.
Sam, do you worry about offending your audience when you're broadcasting?
The worst part about my audience is when I make a pick, like I make a sports bet and it loses, people like anonymously tweet me, "Nice pick, loser." So that's usually what I deal with out here.
Yeah, you will be inevitably sued by someone who follows your advice and then loses their house and their car because of your advice to pick, you know, the Pelicans over the Jazz one night.
Pretty much.
Moving on to our final story involving, I think, one of the more frequent visitors on Legal Face-Off. Not actually, but we've talked a lot about Beyonce over the years.
Beyonce's with us in spirit.
What do you got there, Tina Martini?
So, this is a new one. Beyonce the Witch. So Kimberly Thompson, who is the former drummer for Beyonce, has filed a lawsuit against her, alleging that Beyonce practices extreme witchcraft and has cast magical spells of sexual molestation in order to harass her. She also claims that Beyonce murdered her pet kitten. Thompson sought a TRO against Beyonce, which probably smartly was denied by the LA Superior Court. And a restraining order hearing is scheduled to be held on October 11.
Wow. Where do you go with this story?
I don't know. I mean, there's some other additional graphic detail, but, you know, we have to keep it clean on LFO, so I thought I would.
Kathy, have you ever heard of Beyonce being a witch?
No, not at all.
If you were on this jury, would you find it compelling that Beyonce is practicing extreme witchcraft?
I would think that the lady who's suing her is a little wackadoodle.
A little bit.
Well, what's the difference between just witchcraft and extreme witchcraft?
Exactly.
I think I need to know what the difference is, because I think maybe there's different laws under
it's just a marketing thing. It's like, you know, when they added X to everything back in the late 90s to sell more product.
Extreme Mountain Dew. Yeah. I mean, I think everyone's entitled to a little witchcraft in their shows, but I think extreme is a little. I'm going to have to side with the drummer on this. That's where I draw the line.
What was your favorite extreme product back in the day? I think there was a Zima that I enjoyed extreme Zima. Remember Zima?
Wow.
Love some Zima. I bet if I crack open the martini freezer, there's a couple of old Zimas from 1999.
Yeah, I was going to say actually from 95.
Yeah.
All right, came back. Zima came back last year briefly. I don't know what happened, but they definitely were back.
And clear Pepsi also. All right, so back to Beyonce. We got to ask the inevitable favorite Beyonce song. I'm going to put y'all on the spot here. Tina's looking at me like, don't ask me that question.
I have none.
Well, you're the first one.
She's
so
a witch.
It's
I can't
easy.
Like her music now. I just.
Kathy, any Beyonce favorites?
No, not really.
No, we're striking out on the Beyonce. Paul?
I think that Survivor, but I think that was from the Destiny Child's Day,
yeah,
right?
There you go. Ben is saying
also
yes.
The only name I know by any of the
songs. Susser goes around singing Put a Ring on It.
Favorite Beyonce? Put a ring on it?
Pass.
Put a ring on it. Yeah. Sussler likes that song. Wow. He goes around singing, put a ring on it.
0 for 3 on the, or 0 for 4 on the Beyonce. Well,
what's your favorite one?
I love the classic, put a ring
on it. Yeah, what do you got?
I'm going to say put a ring on it. It's the only Beyonce song.
Can you name 5 Beyonce songs, Rich?
Can I name?
Can you name 5?
There's the a cappella version of Put a Ring on It. There's a reggae version that I'm a fan of.
There's the outtake version.
Exactly. We're getting some looks here across the glass. So I'll turn it over to Sam Panianowicz.
We know yours is Bootylicious, Rich. Don't lie. We know it's Bootylicious.
My favorite song or my actual? Nah, forget it. That's a bridge too far.
Keep it clean.
And with that, we say goodbye. Thank you, Kathy Quilty and Paul Farvar. For Rich and Tina, I'm Sam. That does it for Legal Face-Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat.